This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Was there anybody inside the space shuttle when it flies on the back of the 747?
That could be a bumpy ride.
Well, only if it falls off.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, a man who flew in on the back of a 747 yesterday, Adam Emerson.
Thank you very much, Mike. Wonderful to be back at the podcast.
So, was there anybody inside the space shuttle when it flies on the back of the 747? I think that would be cool.
That could be a bumpy ride.
Well, you think so? Only if it falls off. Anyways, we had Fordham. We're actually on our staff retreat, which we do. We try to do once a year or so. And so we were not in town to see that awesome landing, but the pictures were pretty fantastic.
Fascinating.
All right. We have a lot to cover. Education reform is moving fast. We're going to play part in the gadfly. And then Amber is going to grace us with her research minute. Ty, let's get started and play Pardon the Gadfly.
Mike, you released a policy brief yesterday that argues tight budgets may actually be an opportunity for school districts. Why won't lower spending hurt students?
Well, in many places, lower spending will hurt students because school districts are making bad decisions. We see this, unfortunately, all over the country. For example, laying off teachers and just laying off the youngest teachers, regardless of quality. Furlough Fridays and other ways of shortening learning time. That's not such a good idea. It also hurts on the productivity front. Charging fees for extracurriculars. There are lots of things districts are doing that do hurt kids. And what I try to do in this policy brief is say, hey, that's not your only choice. You also don't have to just give the shaft to the teachers. You know, it's not about saying we're going to have to slash teacher salaries or hold down salaries forever. That is not going to be an effective way to recruit great people into education or to retain the people we've got now. We've really got to think smart about doing things differently. And there's a couple of things. I mean, one is we have in the last 20 years added an enormous number of educational staff members. Most of these new hires are not teachers. They are aides and assistants and coaches and counselors and specialists. And many of these people, but not all of them, work on special education. Others are involved in trying to make the classroom teacher more effective. What you find around the world is this is very unusual. You don't see this as much in high-performing charter schools either. This is a place where we can find ways to cut, to try to say, hey, to classroom teachers, if you can do more without all this support around you, we'll pay you more. And if you can let go of some of those extra people, you save a ton of money, especially on benefits. Yep. Other pieces is technology. It's coming. It's happening. How can we thoughtfully integrate it so that we do on with technology what can be best done on technology, and that frees up teachers to do what they do best in person and be able to do things like have higher class loads because the technology is taking some of that load off their shoulders.
Yep. The best schools, the best school districts know how to build a culture where people wear a lot of different hats and they wear them well. And that, and unfortunately, school districts and schools need a lot of help in figuring out how to do that too.
That's right, and you know the special ed piece is a tricky one, but there's a huge potential for savings there that can produce actually better results for kids, better services with a lot less cost. So, topic number two.
On Sunday, the Wall Street Journal argued that Bobby Jindal's school reform plan may actually be a national milestone in education. But Fordham's own Checker Finn wrote recently that many obstacles will prevent the voucher movement from accelerating. Is private school choice gaining steam or not?
It's gaining momentum. And Checker's right in saying that it's probably not going to accelerate too much because every step forward, and I would say that Bobby Jindal's package was indeed a step forward, there's at least a half step back because at the time that Bobby Jindal got the legislature to pass his education reform package, Jan Brewer, governor out in Arizona, Republican governor out in Arizona, was vetoing a voucher bill. And this is a person who supported school choice in the past. An Oklahoma judge just declared a special education voucher there unconstitutional. So topping the list of Checker's big concerns is still state-level Blaine amendments. It's still the state-level uniformity clauses. These are big fights that every state has to face. So while there is momentum, there is a lot of buildup, and Jindal ought to be applauded for what he's accomplished. It's undoubtedly going to be challenged, just like most policies are at this
point. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a good argument that this is the high water mark because of politics. I mean, all of these barriers are true, and the court challenges are going to be there. But the reason we've got this slew of voucher bills and tax credit bills passing is more than anything else because of the 2010 election, which of course was had nothing to do with vouchers or anything else education-wise. It had to do with Obama's health care plan and the Tea Party revolt and all the rest, sweeping in all these Republican majorities and Republican governors into office. That is not likely to last, regardless of what's happening in the world of politics. You just don't have those kinds of surge elections that then don't get to push back on eventually. And I think, you know, it's pretty likely that lots of these states will turn back to being blue either in 2012 or 2014. So, you know, this is in some ways an accident. Now, you know, give the choice movement credit. It, you know, did a lot of work laying the groundwork so that when they did have these Republican majorities, school choice was at the top of the list in terms of priorities. But I don't think that's a situation we can expect to last.
No, and they're smart to build in some bipartisanship into these measures, but it's minimal at best. I mean, there are some Democrats who Jindal was able to bring on, and there's some Democrats in Florida who support it more so than in many other states, but it's still not enough. Once that political dynamic changes, a lot of things change to this, and we'll see where this goes.
Topic number three.
This morning, Fordham hosted a panel discussion on digital learning. What must policymakers change to make sure this technology is a positive force in education?
Well, Adam, this was a great conversation. At the heart of the debate was this question of whether, if you want to move digital learning forward, can you just tweak a few policies here and there? You know, people talk about things like seat time requirements or teacher certification requirements, or to really get to where to the promised land, you need to overhaul the whole system, the way we finance schools, the way we govern schools, you know, ending local control, local school board control, that these huge systemic issues are going to keep be in the way of us getting to where we need to go. I mean, where do you come down on that when you look at a digital learning?
Well, there does need to be some revolutionary elements to try to get a lot of the stuff passed. Florida was a good example of that. A couple of years ago, there was a pretty good digital learning bill that came through, but it just could not get past the boundaries that were set in place. It couldn't get past a lot of the legislature's own staff and lawyers who said that you can't bring in the statewide private competitors to compete with the public. The Florida Virtual School is even at a state level, there's a lot of resistance to this. So it's not going to be an easy thing to do. But at the same time, Florida is a state, just like many states, that put boundaries around what is essentially something that's boundless.
Well, and that's the big issue, right? I mean, what you'd like to have is a kid anywhere in the state, let's say, be able to go online, have a choice of high quality courses and providers, have some mechanism where they can make a choice among many options, maybe not endless options. You want there to be quality control, but lots of options, and have the money, both state and local, follow that child to that provider. That model is very hard to do when you've got school finance that is such a complicated mess that doesn't follow kids to their providers. There's no mechanism necessarily to pay those providers. And then that school districts very much want to have control over who they can get access to. And school districts increasingly are saying, we'd like to just have them use our own courses with our own teachers or something we've developed instead of something available anywhere. So, you know, this is the classic challenge with competition in education. If the school districts have control over it, their self-interest, at least as they see it, is to limit choice. And that is a shame because, of course, the great potential here is to have, as you say, unlimited potential geography, etc.
Yeah. And John Chubb comes down on empowering state policymakers more with trying to make these changes happen. And I think he comes down on the right side. But even that's going to be challenging to do because you have to change a lot of mindsets in state policy offices that says you can actually do this. Some of them are just as resistant to this kind of change as local school boards are.
All right. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Ty. That's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Amber, you have a huge welt on your arm. I don't like to bring these things up, but not to get too personal, but why is that?
It's because we had this lovely idea at our staff retreat that we would bond as a staff via paintball.
By shooting each other?
Yes.
Shooting each other. How fast do you think those paintballs came a-hurling?
Man, those things go
fast. Enough to create a welt on your arm.
Fast.
I mean, so, ouch. Which was crazy. I really didn't expect that. And those things are like gumballs.
Yeah,
I mean,
they're hard gumballs. Things. They're hard. Yeah.
I was never quite clear about what the team building aspect of this was. I mean, we split into teams and then we tried to kill each other. And,
that's right.
And
you will find out who among us cried first.
There, well, yes, and I was one of them. No.
Yeah, so. I wanted to know who gave me this welp, but nobody fessed up.
Nobody fessed up. You know, most of the time we played, I don't know, three or four different rounds, and most of the time I was the first one out. I just was not good at this.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'd get bored. I know you're supposed to, like, the best thing is you stay behind the tree, stay low. You're not going to get hit.
Hide.
And I'd be like, wait, no, it'd be more fun to go run for that barrier.
Right.
Guess what?
Enough people got in for the boss.
Yeah. You notice that I sat out in the last round. I'm like, done. Just stick a fork at me. I'm over it.
All right. Well, bottom line, I don't think being a military commando is something that I was supposed to go into. So, it's surprising because you think being an education policy wonk is very similar.
It would give you survival skills. I mean, why does that not work that way?
Okay, Amber, what are we talking about today?
New study out by Harvard researchers Tom Hare and Todd Grindel that examine what special education looks like in the Bay State. You guys know what's the Bay State?
Massachusetts.
We all know our state nicknames around here. Analysts examined district, school, and student-level data in roughly 300 school districts. Massachusetts, incidentally, has the second highest identification rate in the U.S. About 17% of K-12 students are eligible for SPED services. Rhode Island, only a state with more, at 19%. Anyway, analysts found that nearly 2 out of 3 SPED students with a disability are identified as having a specific learning disability, SLD, or communication or other health impairment. Those are the categories that have the most subjective diagnoses. They're also called the high incidence category. So anyway, they also found that Massachusetts SPED students score higher on average on NAEP than do SPED students nationally, but obviously they attribute that to the last finding that these are students with less severe disabilities. Substantial variation existed among school districts in identification rates since they have great flexibility in how they interpret disability categories, which is something we actually found our little edge short around here. Anyway, I digress. Many appear to think that wealthier districts identify more students for SPED since they are more likely to advocate for their kids, but they found no evidence of that. In fact, they looked at districts by income, and they basically found that districts with more low-income kids had higher percentages of SPED students. What else do I want to tell you? There were more Black and Latino kids identified for SPED than white kids, but when they controlled for socioeconomic status and other demographics, that disappeared. So I think it was an interesting study. Lots of information. Kudos to EAPS, Todd Grindel, who's on our EAPS program, because it was well laid out. It was understandable. Great presentation. My only beef is cost. There was a mention at the beginning, cost of SPED. Special eds, blah, blah, blah. And then the recommendations, they end up recommending all these sort of pricey interventions for these kids.
And the question is, why so many kids in Massachusetts? I mean, this is twice the rate of roughly as in Texas.
That's
okay,
right.
And some other states. Colorado, I think, is very low. Mm-hmm. California. And you say, what is it about the policy environment in Massachusetts? I mean, we've always assumed it probably is something about financial incentives playing out differently in different states. Mm-hmm. Does this paper give us any clue?
No, but we looked at that a little bit in our SPED short not too long ago. We interviewed people in Massachusetts, and time again, they say it's the culture, it's a generous culture in Massachusetts. They believe that these kids should be taken care of. Obviously, there's some sort of liberal-leaning folks that really push and advocate that. So, yeah, I think it's an uphill battle in terms of their policies. And another thing which is said in here is there's huge flexibility in these squishy sort of categories. And when you don't have the level of specificity that some of these other categories that have, obviously when a kid is blind or can't hear, then it leads to lots of, squishiness and expanding categories.
Yeah, but some of the milder disabilities are kind of harder to figure out.
That's right.
And I guess the question, my bias is that it's not a good thing that so many kids are identified. I mean, we're talking about the kids who are marginal, right?
And
you say moderate disabilities that for the system, it means we're going to spend a lot of money on those kids and have a lot of complicated procedures, the IEPs, and that takes time and tons of staff. And you got 10 people sitting around a room and we're paying for all of them to talk. I mean, just very process-oriented, and that we'd be better off trying to limit that to kids with true disabilities. Mm-hmm. Am I thinking about this wrong, though? I mean, is it possible that those marginal kids are getting a lot better services in Massachusetts than they would if they lived in Texas?
Yeah. I mean, one thing they did also look at that I didn't have time to get into was, were these kids being sort of mainstreamed or pulled out? And they did find that the kids who were being mainstreamed tended to do better than the kids who weren't. Another problem, like, how do we prepare these teachers to teach these kids with, you know, such a spectrum of learning needs?
Though, again, these kids, maybe in most states, the teachers would have these kids. They just wouldn't have a special ed label.
Yeah. Right.
Well, very interesting. Well, thank you, Amber, for bringing us that. All right. That's all the time we got for this week. Till next week.
I'm Adam Emerson.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.